You're listening to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. You can also watch this show at youtube.com/incontextreport. This program will be archived at WPKN.org, on our show's website, incontextreport.com, and on our YouTube channel. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. Hello, I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm joined by In Context military affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe and In Context producer Gus Contivero.
Glad to be back.
Thanks very much for joining us.
The band's back together.
And Marshawn, let's begin with the crisis in the Ukraine. And first, I'd like to give our listeners a little bit of background information. The Ukraine, with a population of about 45 million, lies on Russia's western border and is regarded as the region's breadbasket. About a sixth of Ukraine's population is ethnically Russian, but that underestimates Russians' influence in the Ukraine. Kiev, the capital of the Ukraine, was once the center of a powerful Russian state. And although the center of the Russian state moved to Moscow, the Ukraine was for most of the 20th century a republic within the Russian-dominated Soviet Union. Following the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, the Western military alliance, NATO, moved to rope Eastern Europe into its fold. That effort has been extremely successful, with NATO going so far as to plan missile installations in former Russia allies, Poland and Romania. So far, the NATO reach has not extended to the Ukraine, but not for lack of trying. In 2004, a Western-backed so-called Orange Revolution overthrew a pro-Russian Ukrainian government. But in 2010, a pro-Russian Viktor Yanukovych was elected president. U.S.-backed demonstrations broke out against Yanukovych late in 2013, immediately after his decision not to join the European Union. The opposition movement turned violent in February as gunmen opened fire on both civilians and police. With violence spiraling out of control, the Ukrainian parliament removed the president, who fled the capital, Kiev, for Russian-friendly eastern Ukraine. During the course of this Ukrainian crisis, a taped cell phone conversation between U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland and the U.S. ambassador to the Ukraine was made public, in which it appeared that the U.S. was managing the opposition, and in particular, was aiming to make pro-Western economist Arseniy Yatsenyuk the new leader of the Ukraine. Yatsenyuk was in fact named the new Ukrainian prime minister, and he recently came to the United States to meet with President Obama. Marshawn, now could you please explain Russia's response to the overthrow of the pro-Russian Ukrainian government, with reference in particular to the recent developments in Crimea?
Absolutely. Well, one of the things we saw that was Russia's main concern was, first of all, they lost their pro-Russian surrogate, Viktor Yanukovych, and in his place was placed not only anti-Russian factions, but predominantly fascist and even borderline neo-Nazi factions that are not only opponents of Russia, but have a racial hatred for Russia. In fact, actually, according to the BBC, an article I read this morning, that there were several statements made by the right sector and the Svoboda Party claiming that all of Ukraine's woes were due to Russians and due to Jews. So you see this very heavy former Nazi pattern. And you also see Svoboda Party used to be called, according to Russia Today, it used to be called the National Socialist Party, and then changed its name to Svoboda to make itself more marketable. So what you see is an alliance of very militantly nationalist right-wing parties combined with people like Yatsenyuk, who have very strong ties to the EU, the US, and NATO, and they're coming together. So Russia not only feels the danger in terms of, you know, eventual movement of NATO troops and missiles onto their border, but they also see the potential for an escalation of ethnic violence in the Ukraine directed against ethnic Russians. They also removed Russian as the second language of Ukraine. It is no longer the second language of Ukraine. It can no longer be used in official documents. You have whole areas like Crimea where the population is 90% ethnic Russians, and eastern Ukraine where the population is 70 to 80% ethnic Russians, and they're saying they can't use it. This would be tantamount to the United States saying you can no longer use Spanish in any form in the United States. I mean, imagine the not only the uproar, but the fear that people would feel. So that's why Russia has become very concerned with the revolution.
Why is the Crimea so important? What about this recent referendum in the Crimea? What's the significance of that?
That's very important because Crimea itself, Ukraine is important because all of the natural gas pipelines running to Europe run through Ukraine. But Crimea is the most important because Sevastopol is the home to the Black Sea Fleet. Now, Russia's control over Crimea and over Ukraine itself dates back to the Imperial Age. I mean, I'm talking the time of the Tsars and the time of Peter the Great. Peter the Great fought not only to keep Crimea out of the hands of the Turks, but also to try to expand to control the straits leading between Turkey and the Mediterranean.
And of course,
Dardanelles.
And of course, Crimea juts out into the Black Sea.
Exactly. It juts out into the Black Sea, and it allows the Black Sea fleet at direct access to the Mediterranean. Now, let's not forget, the Russians also have a port in the Mediterranean, the port of Tartus in Syria. So now, between Sevastopol in the Crimea and in the Black Sea, and the port of Tartus, and the establishment of a Russian Mediterranean fleet, something they haven't had since the Cold War, gives Russia a permanent link between these two naval fleets. In essence, it allows for Russia to have full spectrum dominance of the Mediterranean and, by extension, the Middle East, and parts of Southern Europe.
If we just review, what was the outcome? What was the outcome of the election in Crimea, and what's happened with the Ukrainian naval assets in the Black Sea?
According to different sources, but the one I hold the most reliable is Debka, which is an Israeli intelligence newsletter, they held the results at 95.6% in favor of joining Russia. So this tells you the majority of people living in Crimea are ethnic Russians, and even the Tartars, they're ethnic Tartars. They're one of the largest minorities in the Crimea. They're Muslims, and even they seem to have voted largely in favor of joining Russia because they fear these right-wing militants in Kiev, as do most people in Crimea.
What about the allegations of vote rigging and people trying to suppress votes? And I heard that there was a large demographic that just didn't even bother to show up.
A lot of ethnic Ukrainians didn't bother to vote. I did see some of those interviews. A lot of ethnic Ukrainians said, you know, why bother? I mean, the region is almost 90% ethnic Russians.
Okay.
So, really, for most Ukrainians, that, you know, that 10% ethnic Ukrainians who don't want to leave, well, their votes really probably wouldn't have had as much of an impact.
So hence the higher than 90% positive vote. Basically, every Russian voted in favor of joining Russia. They had another parliamentary referendum, not a vote, but the parliament itself voted to appeal to join Russia, and then they changed their actual time zone to Moscow time and made ruble the official currency of the region, right?
Exactly. And President Putin actually signed into law recognition of Crimea as an independent state and received a formal application for membership, if you will, into the Russian Federation from the new Crimean parliament. But one of the things that's the most significant, though, is at the effect that you're seeing outside of Crimea, because one could argue that this is isolated strictly to Crimea because of its large ethnic Russian population. But on March 1st, the Ukrainian Navy flagship, the Hetman Sahaidachny, it's a frigate. It is the flag. It's a flagship of the Ukrainian Navy, the pride of the Ukrainian Navy. On March 1st, it defected. It lowered the Ukrainian naval ensign and raised the St. Andrew's flag, which is the Russian naval flag. In addition to that, on March 2nd, according to the BBC, on March 2nd, the newly appointed head of Ukraine's Navy, this guy was appointed right afterwards, Denis Berezovsky. He defected and swore allegiance to the new Ukrainian government.
Wow.
I mean, the new Crimean government.
Right.
New Crimean government.
Sure.
So you're seeing a lot of very high-level moves. So it's very clear that this is not just a minor ethnic squabble like is being depicted in much of the mainstream media. You know, a bunch of radical Russians trying to, you know, separate themselves from Ukraine. That's also what's happening, because I imagine on this frigate you had a lot of ethnic Ukrainians.
Wow. Could you really get any more similar to the 1960s Cold War, where you just had people jumping over the fences trying to change sides in both directions, just trying to set themselves up for a position?
Well, it's interesting that, you know, the Cold War supposedly ended in 1991, but almost as soon as it ended, the United States under George Bush Sr. Mm-hmm. began this policy of military escalation, expansion, turning NATO from a defensive alliance intended to protect Western Europe from the Soviet Union into an offensive alliance, starting out with the war in the 1990s, where we broke up Yugoslavia, of course, the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, the attack in Libya. Yeah, the Cold War ended, but it just turned into a new kind of war. Let's talk about the U.S. response.
Okay.
Well, the U.S. has taken some military steps. It's deploying 10 F-15s to Lithuania. It's sending F-16s to Poland. And it has a ship in the Black Sea, which is...
The U.S. has Tuxton.
Drilling with the Romanians and the Bulgarians. So there are some military efforts being made. On the diplomatic front, the United States is trying to get the UN to declare that the secession vote was unconstitutional mm-hmm. and illegal interference with a sovereign. Are these steps going to be efficacious, Marshawn, do you think?
No, the whole sanctions are completely lunatic. I mean, I've yet to see anyone on Fox News, CNN, or MSNBC mention the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is basically the new economic Warsaw Pact, if you will. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization is an economic union that consists of Russia, China, India, South Africa, and Brazil, all of the world's major emerging economies. Now, these countries are tied to Russia because Russia is building nuclear plants in South Africa. They're selling arms to South Africa. They're selling arms to India. They're building nuclear plants in India. So if we want to effectively sanction Russia, we have to also sanction India, South Africa, Brazil, and
right.
China.
Not happening.
It's not going to happen. And in fact, I saw on the BBC just this morning that the British government, with regards to the sanctions, was going to be having a list of people that were exempt from the sanctions because Russia has so much investment in Britain. In essence, to truly sanction Britain, sanction Russia, we would not only need to virtually destroy our own economy, but we would destroy that of Europe because Germany gets all of its oil and natural gas from Russia. France, in addition to getting natural gas from Russia, also sells billions of dollars in arms to Russia. And Britain has so much investment from Russia. It's woefully impractical. In addition to that, there are a lot of elements inside Europe that see Russia's actions as being justified. There was the leader of the Bundestag left-wing party. So he's the left-wing coalition in the German Bundestag. And he spoke 2 days ago on the issue of Crimea's breaking away. Now, Angela Merkel, the chancellor of Germany, said that this is illegal, it's against international law. And this German left-wing party leader said that what Russia is doing is completely justifiable because NATO has broken its promise when Germany reunified. That, you know, they promised not to put any more troops in Germany. They promised not to put any more troops in Eastern and Western Europe. NATO did. The U.S. did. And so you see a lot of sentiment in Europe, resentment, if you will, saying what Russia is doing is they see as, well, maybe it's justifiable, maybe it's not justifiable, but NATO hasn't been very good to us either. And certainly there are a lot of elements in Britain, like George Galloway, who's the Member of Parliament for Glasgow, who appeared on Russia Today, who said that are condemning Russia's and sanctioning Russia for its support of the Crimea is lunatic because we allowed Yugoslavia to break up. We allowed Kosovo to break away from Serbia, even though the Serbian government didn't want it. We're allowing this coming fall, Scotland's going to vote for its independence.
Well, we need Scotland to talk about the whole strategic situation since the collapse of the Cold War has been to bring all of the former Warsaw Pact and some of the Soviet republics into the NATO alliance and effectively encircle Russia. So,
well, it just shows the contradictions that we have in our foreign policy because we have a problem with countries breaking up when it doesn't favor our position. But when it comes to countries that want to join the United Nations or to join NATO or to join the EU or something like that, yeah. We're all for it.
Well, it's like that. There was a very good political cartoon which showed military bases of the United States around Russia. And the caption said, why did the Russians locate their country so near U.S. military bases?
That's their fault.
That's their fault. You
right,
know,
right.
Blame the Vikings who settled there 2,000 years ago, you know.
So how is the military situation, do you think, going to evolve? It looks like Crimea may develop into a situation de facto a part of Russia. Are the Russians going to attempt, do you think, to move militarily in to eastern Ukraine to perhaps annex the populations, the Russian-dominated areas of the eastern Ukraine? And if so, what would the Western response be?
It was an article in the Daily Mail which said that Russia has 80,000 troops mobilized on the Ukrainian border. In addition, the New York Times also reported that Russian troops are massing on the Ukrainian border. And this is as of March 12th, they began massing. Now, yeah. The Ukrainian response has been to start deploying troops to their eastern border. And they, as of today, they voted to mobilize 40,000 reservists. Now, the tricky part is that their forces are being stopped by, quote unquote, Russian self-defense forces in the east of the Ukraine. So the Ukrainians are having difficulty moving their troops in. from a wider perspective, this is the equivalent of the Anschluss, which was when Germany, it means reunification in German. It was when Germany annexed the Sudetenland, Austria, and then eventually invaded Czechoslovakia. Yeah. We're seeing the same thing. It's not under the same pretenses, although for Germany, these were all lands that they lost under the Treaty of Versailles. So they felt they had to go and protect ethnic Germans, if you will. Mm-hmm. Well, the Russians lost all of these lands under the treaties that followed the Cold War, the end of the Cold War. So you're seeing the same phenomena. And just as you did when with the Anschluss, you're seeing a very weak and inept West that wants to do something, but really isn't willing to commit. The problem is that this will invariably lead to a wider confrontation. In the eastern Ukraine, there have been attacks by the right sector and the Svoboda supporters against ethnic Russians. Now, again, how much of this might be a false flag or even encouraged by whether by the Russians or by the West is unclear, but it is giving Russia the cost belli, if you will, to invade eastern Ukraine to protect ethnic Russians. And in fact, people in eastern Ukraine have called for not only a referendum to join Russia, but also called for Russian peacekeepers to protect them.
Mm-hmm. And nobody at this point in the United States, as far as I know, is calling for American troops to be sent to the Ukraine.
Well, you know what? If we hadn't burned ourselves out on in the last 12 years of endless disputes around the world, that you may have been able to rattle some support. But because of the fact that we're just winding down in Iraq and Afghanistan and coming home from conflicts that have dragged on forever around the world, there's no public support. People are just fatigued and exhausted on combat that just never ends. And they see this as just another project of the interventionists in government, and they're just absolutely sick of it.
What is the attitude of the Germans and the French and the British?
Well, they're very frightened. They're very frightened because what they're seeing is, again, they have a long memory. They're remembering the Anschluss. And they're remembering that this was the precursor to the Germans invading Poland and invading France. Now, this is another issue, too. All of these Eastern European countries, Ukraine being the exception, but all of the Balkan states, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Romania, these are all NATO countries. So if Russia continues to expand, and certainly they could into the Balkan states, because the Balkan states have large ethnic Russian populations. If the Russians were to do that, it would drag in NATO and the U.S. against its will. Now, Gus, you made a phenomenal point when you talked about the attitude of the American people. I think that's one of the reasons why the American people have so far been very silent on the issue of the referendum, Russia's annexation. But the people making the most noise have been American politicians, people like John McCain saying, we have to do this. And something I worry about is that
Obama seems really invested in it for some reason, like he's personally offended.
Oh, exactly. Well, I think he is because it's an affront to America's status as the world hegemon. For the first time since the end of the Cold War, another country is telling us to basically kick rocks. And so I think and that's the reason why our politicians are dragging us into almost a war footing. I mean, there's been talk in the White House of sending arms to the Ukraine. So it's entirely possible that just like with Libya, our politicians may drag us into a war.
So we're going to have to watch this, Marshawn. We're going to have to watch this confrontation between the U.S. and Russia very carefully and hope that cooler heads prevail and this doesn't result in another major conflict between the big powers. You're listening to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. You can also watch this show at youtube.com/incontextreport. This program will be archived at WPKN.org, on our show's website, incontextreport.com, and on our YouTube channel. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. Marshawn, let's talk about Vladimir Putin now, the man who's led Russia for the last 14 years. How would you rate Vladimir Putin's effectiveness as a national leader?
Well, I would definitely put him up there with the likes of Russian leaders such as Peter the Great. He has taken Russia from the Dark Ages and brought it into the 21st century. If you go to any major Russian news station, radio station, they're all broadcasting online. I have an app on my phone that allows me to play 50 different Russian radio stations. Now, you compare this with the state Russia was in even in 2000. it was a third world country. And now he's pulled it kicking and screaming, just as Peter the Great did, into the 20th century. This doesn't mean Russia's a wonderful place everybody would want to live in. Mind you, it still is an authoritarian regime, just as it was under the czars. But authoritarian state though it may be, he's done what very few Russian leaders have been able to do before him. He's also brought Russia militarily to the point where it can go toe-to-toe with the West. I mean, Russia was behind defeating the United States' efforts in Syria and defeating the United States' efforts against Iran. Putin has built Russia from a third world country that it was in 1991 to a modern superpower that can not only defy the West, but directly challenge it.
Tell us about Vladimir Putin's background, especially his experience with the KGB and his rise to power.
Putin was somebody who always had a single-minded sense of purpose. There's a great documentary, if our viewers and listeners ever get the chance to see it, called The Putin System. It was made by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. And it's about the life of Vladimir Putin. One of the things they talk about from interviews with people who've known him is from the time he was a child, he was always fascinated with the Russian secret service, the spy agencies and whatnot. He always used to watch the Stalinist classics, the great World War II movies of the Stalinist era. But this says a lot about the man himself. He was somebody who was very single-minded. He had a focus. And when he was a teenager, he entered the office of the KGB in Leningrad, where he was born, and asked to join. You don't have many teenagers in most parts of the world. You know, you don't have very many teenagers lining up to ask the CIA if they can join. But this kid, as a teenager, was asking to join the KGB, and they said, no, you don't ask to join, we ask you to join. But go to school, go to St. Petersburg University, which is a KGB school, mind you, and study law and languages. So he went, when he was in law school, he was approached by the KGB. And in 1975, became an agent working in East Germany, a very successful agent, mind you, working with the German Stasi. And he rose to the rank of lieutenant colonel in 1991 when the Soviet Union fell.
In 91, there's the coup. The Soviet Union collapses. Gorbachev's efforts for a new, more democratic, volunteer Soviet Union fails, I think partly because of American interference. And Yeltsin, who seems to be backed by the United States, takes power. The Soviet Union is quickly dismantled. What is Putin's role in the Yeltsin administration, and how does he move into a position of power?
Putin was very clever. Let's not make any mistake about it. He was a diehard Soviet. I mean, his mentor was Yuri Andropov, who was the head of the KGB and eventually premier of the Soviet Union. Now, he was Putin's mentor. So Putin never lost focus of that, but he also knew what he had to do to get into power, because he felt that Boris Yeltsin and his crowd betrayed Russia. But in the same vein, he knew he couldn't stand up to him. So he aligned himself with his former law professor, Anatoly Sobchak, and actually helped elect Sobchak to the position of mayor of St. Petersburg. Through this, he worked his way, because Sobchak was very closely connected to Yeltsin. And when Yeltsin came to Sobchak and said, listen, I need a man from KGB who can do the dirty work for me, in essence, do you know anyone? Sobchak said, oh yeah, I know this guy, Vladimir Putin, he'll be your man. And that's how Putin sort of wormed his way into the Yeltsin family, which was actually called the family, believe it or not. That was the nickname they gave themselves. You know, if you could
very mobster-esque.
Exactly. Kid sounding more like
this was a time, in fact, that the Soviet Union's great public resources were being privatized to the benefit of a handful of so-called oligarchs and Western investors.
Boris Berezovsky, Abramovich, yeah.
So this doesn't sound like a program that Putin, knowing as we do, that he would have supported, but he endured this Yeltsin administration and survived it.
He did, because he knew he had to. Again, Putin's very much a man with a single-minded focus. He knows what he has to do. He knows what his goal is. His goal is the restoration of the Soviet Union, but more than that, the restoration of Russian glory. It's the restoration of Russia as an empire, which is also why he's an authoritarian. He squashes unrest, but that was also how he dealt with the oligarchs. In 1998, he became head of the FSB. Now,
the FSB is?
They were the successors to the KGB. You had the KGB after the Soviet Union was dissolved, it became the FSB. Mm-hmm. But it was the same organization. During their ceremonies, they still kiss the flag that has the hammer and sickle on it. I mean, nothing's changed. It was rare because the FSB, unlike our CIA, is an army. It's a virtual army. And so when he became head of FSB, it would be like taking a lieutenant colonel from our active duty army and putting him in charge of the entire armed forces. But because he was old KGB, the FSB men trusted him. And there's actually a famous video of Putin after he became president when he's speaking at the Dzerzhinsky Club. Dzerzhinsky was the first head of the Cheka, which became the KGB. And during the speech, he said, I promised that the KGB would come back to power. Today, I have fulfilled that promise. And so he always had a very single-minded focus. We have a very sort of love-hate relationship with the CIA in terms of, you know, a lot of like, do this, you know, ran contra. But for the Russians, their relationship with the KGB and later on with the FSB was these were the people who were still loyal to the Russia that they knew, whereas everybody else had betrayed it. And one thing that Putin did when he was head of the FSB is he gathered information on all of these oligarchs. So that in 1999, when he became prime minister by Boris Yeltsin, he was named prime minister. And then because of Yeltsin's failing health, in December of 1999, December 31st, he was made president by interim. As soon as becoming president, he then won the election in 2000, in May of 2000, he had gathered all of the oligarchs together in a room. And he said, it's business as usual, but stay out of politics. And the message was very clear. You guys, you can keep doing business, but you're done. You're not in politics anymore. And he knew they'd stand up to him.
But what was the condition of the?
He crushed him.
What was the condition of the economy and particularly of the military when Putin took over from Yeltsin?
It was in tatters. I mean, the Russian military, and you can see from their performance in the first Chechen war in the mid '90s, the Russian military performed appallingly badly. They lost. They lost a war to a band of poorly armed Chechen rebels. Second Chechen war, they did a little better, but that's because Putin's personality. Again, when he was made president by interim, typically the president-elect would go to the Bolshoi Theater to watch, you know, an opera and everybody would see. But the presidential box was empty because the moment Putin was put in charge of the country, he went right to the Chechen front and handed out personally engraved daggers to the soldiers fighting on the front. So I think it was his personality that actually won the Second Chechen War. Mm. It was him. He was the first Russian leader to actually, again, that Peter the Great mentality, you know.
Right.
I'm going to be on the front lines. I'm leading from the front. I mean, can you imagine today an American president going to a war zone with the bullets whizzing overhead? You know,
no, so I can't.
That won him a tremendous amount of affection, but that also won him the loyalty of the military.
Right, right.
So he took this disheveled military. But the first thing he did was he stood up to the oligarchs. He then arrested them individually for tax evasion and all sorts of other things, and then appropriated all of their wealth. Because the Russian government had loaned all this money out to the oligarchs. Now he called them on their debt, which they obviously couldn't pay back. So he appropriated them and everything that was owned by them. One of the major TV stations, NTV, that was owned by Boris Berezovsky, was taken over by Gazprom, which is a state-owned natural gas company. But that company now owns everything in Russia because everything was appropriated into that one entity, which now meant he took back everything that had been stolen and brought it back to the coffers of the Russian government. And now that allowed him to start reforming the military, rebuilding the military, rebuilding the infrastructure and the economy. He kicked out all of the foreigners that were hired by these oligarchs and employed Russians instead, which also helped revitalize the Russian economy.
One of the major objectives of his administration is to be the restoration of the Russian military as a means of thwarting the encirclement of Russia by NATO. How would you assess his strategy at this point?
I think it's very successful. I mean, at this stage, Europe really is not in a position to get directly involved in the sense that Putin realized when he wrote Russia in the New Millennium, which was really his manifesto, he wrote that the control of natural resources would allow you to basically control the world. And because he controls all the oil and natural gas going into Europe, Europe's not in a position really to oppose him, effectively, that is. And the United States is far too weak. And he saw that by testing us in Syria, by the fact that we bungled so badly in Syria, the fact that you were able to have a pro-Russian coup in Syria. I mean, I'm sorry, not in Syria, a pro-Russian coup in Egypt, which brought to power General el-Sisi, demonstrated beyond a shadow of a doubt that the United States was largely an ineffective opponent, and therefore Russia could really flex its military muscle and its national muscle. So I think what the Russians are doing, it's very well thought out. It's very methodical. Again, it's like when he took on the oligarchs, he didn't just decide overnight, I'm going to take him on. He built up all of the files, all of the networks, and then he took them down in, you know, a one fell swoop, as they say. So I think you see the same exact thing that's going on now.
Not to mention that Europe is economically not in a position to oppose anything. I mean, they have no money to pay for their own public sector obligations in many of the countries. Their public debt is just so overwhelming that there's just no way that they're going to be able to put an opposition together to force Russia to do anything, you know, hand back Crimea or anything like that.
And that's one of the things that's also the United States is very afraid of. And one of the things that NATO, I think, is very afraid of is the fact that on the one hand, you have this Russian expansion in the East, but because of the incredible economic hardships in Western Europe, especially in places like Italy and Greece and Spain and even Ireland, what you can see eventually is the Russians trying to topple governments in there, putting pro-Russian left-wing governments, which wouldn't be beyond the realm of possibility.
Well, we're just going to have to watch
many
this great drama played out. But certainly Vladimir Putin, 14 years as a leader of Russia, is going to continue to play a significant role in this East-West confrontation. You're listening to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. You can also watch this show at youtube.com/incontextreport. This program will be archived at WPKN.org, on our show's website, incontextreport.com, and on our YouTube channel. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. Hello, I'm your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe, and I'm joined by In Context military affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott-Rowe, bless you, and In Context producer Gus Canavero. Marshawn, tell us, what is the strategic importance of Ukraine?
Well, Ukraine is not only important because it provides Europe with all of its oil and natural gas, but it's also strategically important because it provides Russia with its port on the Black Sea, the port of Sevastopol in the Crimea, which as of today is now part of Russia.
If we look at the Ukraine, it's bordering obviously on the western border of Russia. If it were to become part of the alliance, it would bring the danger of NATO practically inside Russia.
Exactly. And the reason why Ukraine is so important is because if you bring NATO up, now Russia is completely hemmed in. Additionally, because of Russia's port on the Black Sea, the port of Sevastopol, if you were to control the whole of Ukraine, including the Crimea, you would now deny Russia its only warm water port. This is significant because it's the only port outside of the port of Tartus in the Mediterranean where the Russian Navy can freely move year-round, as opposed to Vladivostok all the way in the east, or their major naval bases out in the west, which are iced in for parts of the year. You now have a port that allows Russian Navy constant movement. So if we were to control the Ukraine, it would not just hem in Russia, but it would also hamper Russia's military capabilities.
Sure.
I mean, in essence, it would be like cutting the legs off of their navy.
And of course, they have a very important port in Syria, at Tartus, because of their alliance with the Assad government. And if they lost control of the Black Sea, they would have a hard time utilizing that port.
So in other words, it becomes clear and obvious why Western forces would want to foment the revolution in Ukraine, in light of the ousted president's deal with Russia.
And of course, this fight over the Crimea is an old fight between the West and Russia. Perhaps, Marshawn, you could talk about the Crimean War that occurred in the middle of the 19th century.
Absolutely. And the Crimean War really highlights the importance of the Crimea to Russia. And it also highlights why the Russians supported the referendum on March 16th to allow Crimea to join Russia. The Crimean War, which was 1853 to 1856, was fought between the Russians on one side and the Brits, the French, and the Turks on the other. The goal of the British, the French, and the Turks was to dislodge the Russians from the Crimea, deny them their only warm water port, and it would ultimately allow European full-spectrum dominance over the Russian Navy, because the only way the Russian Navy could ever rival the Royal Navy was by having that warm water port. It was a brutal war, but the Russians committed everything they had to winning the war because that's how important the Crimea is. You had a coalition of the three largest military powers at the time in the world, because we got to remember the United States was not a superpower at the time. So you had the world's three largest military powers, the Ottoman Empire, the French, and the British. Those three combined could not dislodge the Russians because the Russians were going to commit everything they had to defending the Crimea. So, and that's why you see that the Russians on March 17th also agreed to not only accept the Crimea, but to the establishment of Russian military bases inside the Crimea and the deployment of Bastion anti-ship defense missiles, because right. that's just how important it is.
Well, if you learn anything from Russian military history, it's that they will throw everything they have at you.
Absolutely. I mean, if you really want to understand the Russian mentality, look at World War II. Look at World War I. I mean, World War I, the Russians lost 100,000 men in one day at the Battle of Tannenberg. And in World War II, what they committed to battles like Stalingrad, Leningrad, the Siege of Moscow, Kursk, Kharkov, which, by the way, were both in the Ukraine, what you see is that the Russians will suffer absolutely unimaginable hardships just to be independent of foreign occupation. And this dates back all the way to the Mongol invasion, because before the Mongol invasion, Russia was a small kingdom, which its capital was Kiev. The kingdom of the Rus was mm-hmm. their capital was Kiev. The Mongols came in and burned it. The Russians were subjugated by the Mongols for several hundred years, and that left a psychological scar. Russians will suffer unimaginable hardships in order to be independent. And you're seeing that now with the Ukraine. If the Ukraine falls into the Western sphere, Russia is truly occupied. Not physically, per se, that there's a NATO army inside Russia, but they're hemmed in on every front.
The Ukraine was a very important prize in another great conflict between East and West in World War II. What role did the Ukraine play in that conflict?
The Ukraine was a pivotal battlefield. Kharkov was one of the epic battles of World War II. The Germans and the Russians slogged it out. That was one of those points in the war where Kharkov, Kursk, the battle could have gone either way. You know, had the Germans won, they might have been able to turn the tide. But it played an important role because that was really where the Russian pushback against the Germans began. Because Stalingrad is always seen as the turning point, but really the push against the Germans really began in Ukraine and in Belarus.
Did the Ukrainian people in World War II back the Russians, or was Ukrainian nationalism a factor?
Ukrainian nationalism was a factor. I mean, you did have SS units that were Ukrainian. You had foreign units of the German Wehrmacht that were Ukrainian. So there were Ukrainian elements that backed the Nazis. But the biggest reason why was not out of ethnic nationalism, but rather out of an unbelievable hatred of Stalin. You had Cossacks. You had a Russian Free Army. They were called the Russian Liberation Army under General Vlasov. And they had a couple hundred thousand men.
Are these the ancestors of the Svoboda Party, you might say?
Yeah, the ancestors of the Svoboda Party, you see two patterns, because you see these former SS, you see members of the Wehrwolves, who were Nazi guerrillas that were left behind, and you also see the remnants of Operation Gladio. Now, Gladio was a CIA stay-behind operation that in the event of a Russian invasion, these former Wehrwolves, former German SS resistance fighters, would rise up and fight the Soviets. And now what you're seeing is these guys are bringing out, it's from the Svoboda Party, the right sector, they're bringing out the Volksangel and all these former Nazi emblems.
And also, I know a Ukrainian and I know a Pole, and it is very interesting to see that they will, in a second, align themselves with the mentality of the Nazi Party over the Russian socialist because of the hardship that was incurred during the Soviet occupation of those countries.
Well, and when you look at it, I mean, unless you were a Jew, really, if you were a Ukrainian, if you were a Pole, what the Nazis represented was liberation from Stalin's system. Because what you're really seeing here is, again, the legacy of the Stalinist occupation of Poland, the Stalinist occupation of the Ukraine. Stalin killed millions of Poles, millions of Ukrainians. In Stalin's rule, he killed more people than were killed by Hitler. He killed upwards of 20, 25 million of his own people.
Yeah.
Not to mention the 20 million that were killed during the war. And even the 20 million that were killed during the war were largely killed by Stalin.
But could you see this being resolved with Ukraine being fragmented into the Russian areas in the east and in the Crimea and some kind of a rump Ukrainian state, which would be anti-Russian and allied with the West?
I don't think so. The West has to realize one of two things. More importantly, the Americans have to realize one of two things. Either we are going to accept Russian hegemony in the world. We're going to fall back. We're going to say, you know what? The rest of the world is yours. We're going to defend our own homeland. Or alternatively, we decide we're going to stand up to the Russians to give up Eastern Ukraine and Crimea. It acknowledges Russian hegemony. The U.S. would have to allow that in order to accept a split Ukrainian state. And we saw this in Syria. The Russians, for the first time, stopped the United States from invading a country.
And of course, we've been trying for years to overthrow Syria. As we've been reporting on In Context, the supposed Syrian indigenous democratic revolution was really a rigged deal done by Qatar and Saudi Arabia, with importing Islamist fighters from Libya, training them on the Syrian-Turkish border, and then inserting them in Syria to destabilize the Assad government under the guise of an indigenous uprising.
The Russians not only have defended Assad, they've toppled the Egyptian government and put in a pro-Russian surrogate. In addition, there's no guarantee that they're going to stop in eastern Ukraine. They might go into western Ukraine. They might go into the Baltic states. They might topple governments in Poland. They might bring left-wing governments in Greece, Italy, Spain, Ireland even, countries that have strong left-wing leanings to begin with, and because of a bad economy, might listen to Russian advisors. For the United States, more than any other country, this is the make-it-or-break-it moment for U.S. hegemony.
The Ukraine dispute could end up spilling over into becoming a much wider challenge to the encirclement of Russia by NATO. You're listening to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. You can also watch the show at youtube.com/incontextreport. This program will be archived at WPKN.org, on our show's website, incontextreport.com, and on our YouTube channel. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. Hello, I'm your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe, and I'm joined by In Context military affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott-Rowe and In Context producer Gus Canavero.
Hey.
Marshawn, every sane person wishes that the rivalry between Russia and the United States won't lead to a direct military conflict. But if such a conflict were to break out, is the United States prepared for it?
Absolutely not. One of the problems is that we've been investing in counterinsurgency hardware since the beginning of the Iraq War and the Afghan War. In the case of drones, in terms of MRAPs, armored personnel carriers, none of our hardware has been devoted to fighting a conventional war. We're, technologically speaking, not prepared. In addition to, we also are not prepared in terms of numbers. Just to give you a few statistics, Russia has a standing army of 766,000 men. Their reserve force is roughly 2,035,000. Mm. They also have conscription, which it lasts for 1 year. So that means that if they truly wanted to, they could call up millions of men and women who have military training. By comparison, the U.S. has a standing army of 490,000. This is the smallest our force has been since before World War II. Our reserve is 199,000. That's not including our National Guard. But in the event of a major war, we would need our guard for the home front. What you're seeing here is, in terms of our reserve, we have a tenth the reserve that they do. In terms of our active duty, we have just a little more than half the active duty force. In addition, the Russian military has been designed for a conventional war. When they fought the Chechens, they didn't fight even the insurgency. They fought it in a conventional fashion. You know, they met an ambush, they blew it up with a tank. You know, that's just the Russian way of doing business. Whereas on the other hand, our military has been very over-technologically focused. And you can see the inadequacies in our technology by the fact that the Russians, according to Debka file, the Israeli intelligence newsletter, brought down one of our drones over the Crimea on March 15th.
Mm-hmm.
So Debka file is a very reliable news agency. Now, the United States...
Which shows that our reliance on technology is not infallible.
Absolutely. And you can see that by the fact that the Iranians brought down our secret CIA RQ-170 spy drone.
Possibly so, with the aid of Russian technology.
Exactly.
So what you're implying is that our bias towards technology is perhaps not wise, and that we should focus more on the boots on the ground?
Absolutely. Because let's look at military history. You know, people always neglect history because they say it'll never happen again, which is the same thing they said after the Hundred Years' War, same thing they said after the French and Indian Wars, same thing they said after World War One, and the same thing they're saying now, right, post-World War II.
Yeah, the war to end all wars was World War One, right?
Exactly. And we still have the same mentality. Let's not forget, Germany during World War II had the best, bar none, the best military hardware. They had the world's first jet. They had the King Tiger tank, which you could only destroy by hitting with an airplane bomb. They had the world's first assault rifle, the Sturmgewehr 44. And their heavy and light machine guns, the MG-42, was far better than our .30 caliber machine gun. But the fact is...
Rockets, V1 and V2.
V1 and V2 rockets, which put a man on the moon, by the way. But the fact is, though, is that in spite of having the best hardware, they just couldn't produce enough of it. And our Shermans were terrible compared to the German tanks. We could just produce more. And you're seeing that now with Russia. The Russian hardware that they're producing is actually pretty darn good. It's not subpar to our technology. It's actually on par with our technology or more advanced than it. Mm. And in addition, they can produce a heck of a lot more than we can. All of our jets, all of our tanks, parts for them are made in China.
Oh, that's scary.
Oh, yeah. Parts to our tanks, computer hardware that goes in our jets are made in China.
How would you compare the training of the average American soldier and the equipment, say the M16, compared to the training of the Russian and the basic infantry weapon that he uses?
The Russian training is much more rigorous than ours. It's much more focused on killing, too. Ours is very, very politicized. We do not do bayonet training anymore, which is anachronistic, as I remember President Obama said, you know, during World War I, we had horses and battleships. Well, let's face it, in every war, your soldiers may have to go hand to hand, and you may still need to use horses, because during World War II, all sides used horses. Just throwing that out there. But the fact is that their training is oriented towards killing. It is oriented towards the functions of a soldier in the harshest conditions. Likewise, their Kalashnikov, the AK-12, which is what they use now, is the same thing. In fact, to test the AK-12, they have Spetsnaz, which are Russian special forces, bring it with them on training exercises. And the Russians famously said, if we can create the world's perfect soldier, we would create a soldier like the Kalashnikov. You know, and that's exactly the Russian mentality. By comparison with our army, we don't use the term kill anymore. You shoot to eliminate the threat. You know, we don't do bayonet training because that's scary and involves, you might actually have to kill somebody. We like drones. We like the touchy-feely stuff. You know, blowing somebody up with a drone doesn't look like you're killing a person. You're killing a little animated guy, you know? It's like playing Call of Duty, you know? So this is a very much removed concept. Additionally, Russian soldiers in their special forces school die during training. They accept a 12% some odd death rate in their special forces training. So the Russians, they have a surplus of people.
And they get volunteers nonetheless.
Yeah, right.
They have a surplus of people. But this tells you something about the Russian mindset. You see this again when you look at Russian military history. Russian soldiers astounded the Germans in World War II because temperatures would get so cold that the bolts of the rifles would freeze. The machine gun actions would not be able to work because they'd be so unbearably cold. And the Germans thought there is no way enemy soldiers could be moving in this, and the Russians would still attack. So this is a mentality that's something that we don't train. We don't train our soldiers anymore in this kind of do or die mentality. So that's where you see the psychological and the technological differences. Our M4-2 is garbage compared to their Kalashnikov.
Don't you end up with a staleness that happens from empire? You know, we've been running an empire for decades now, and we fear no one. And we have this propaganda that is disseminated by our government and our television and radio that America is the greatest country in the world and that we are second to none in any category that you can possibly imagine. And Americans buy it, and by and large, they believe that.
You know, we've been talking a lot about the Russian-American confrontation in Europe, really over NATO's encirclement of Russia. But, Marcia, one of the technology aspects that allows Russia to project its power is its advanced submarine. Could you talk about the submarines, their ability to cross the Atlantic, and the fact that they have a base in Venezuela?
Oh, yes. The Russians have established a naval base in Venezuela to rearm and refuel their submarines. Their submarines are some of the most advanced in the world. They have the new Bure-class submarine, which is the world's first silent submarine. Now, I know this sounds like something out of Tom Clancy, but it's because it is. It's a silent propulsion system. What it is hydraulic. So on the one hand, you have the submarine, and what pushes it forward is it sucks in water through these intakes and forces it out the back. What this means is that there's no propeller system. And this means that it's virtually undetectable. In addition, they coated it with a material to also make it difficult to detect on sonar.
Right.
So now you have the fact that the engine's running silent on top of the fact that it's also much harder to detect because of the material. And then moreover, it's equipped with the new Bulava missile. Now the Bulava missile is beautiful if you're not on the receiving end of it. It has 12 independently guided warheads. And each of these independently guided warheads also carry their own countermeasures. So they can't be jammed. They can't be shot, or they're difficult to shoot down. They had some trouble when they were first tested, and the Russian government basically told the manufacturer, you're not getting a penny more until we get a finished product. And sure enough, they got a finished product because the manufacturer wanted the money.
But this is not a. These are not nuclear warheads, though, right? They're conventional.
They could be any. They could be.
Oh, they could be
nuclear tipped, chemical, conventional, or incendiary. To be honest, if you really wanted to wreak havoc in an urban center, but you didn't want the fallout of radiation, you use incendiary or high explosive conventional warheads. You launch them into a clustered urban city and you start major fires. It's the modern modern idea of firebombing.
Right.
And the advantage is because you have these silent submarines, you could Dresden, exactly, perfect example. You could drive up along our coast. We would never know they were there. If they launch them, again, if they refuel in Venezuela and resupply in Venezuela, they can run up our east coast and they can hammer every major American city. One Bulava has 12 warheads. So if you have two of these, they each carry roughly 12 to 18 missiles, each with 12 warheads inside the each individual missile. So one submarine could devastate every major city in the United States, let alone if you had a couple, you could decapitate our entire command and control structure.
And as
so
proof,
this is very dangerous.
As proof of this, we have two articles within the last 5 or 6 years where this happened, where there was one of these submarines that was present off the coast of San Diego when the Carnival Splendor had that ship fire and was left stranded in the ocean for, I think it was like 8 hours before a Navy vessel approached it. And there was a report of a submarine hightailing it out of that area. And there was also another report where the Russians even admitted that they had a submarine off of Tampa Bay, Florida, that was undetected, I think, for up to 3 months, where it was literally just sitting in the Gulf of Mexico, just checking to see if we would find it.
Something that the American people need to realize is this fight that we're picking with Russia over the Ukraine has much, much wider implications.
Exactly, exactly.
Because if Russia decided to, like that, they could decapitate our entire infrastructure, our entire military command and control structure, without firing a nuclear warhead. And
Washington, D.C. is right on the coast. I mean, it's a pretty ridiculous place to put your capital in the modern day.
Do our leaders, exactly. Do our readers acknowledge or are they aware of the vulnerability of this country to an attack or on the continental
I'm
going to
guess no.
I think there's so much self-delusion that goes on. I mean, just turn on any major American media outlet. Again, all of the facts that I'm giving are all open source. People can Google this. The problem is our politicians don't. Most people don't because it's, you know, it's labor intensive. They want to turn on Fox or CNN or MSNBC right. and see, you know, the warm and fuzzy.
Dude, we haven't been invaded since the War of 1812. Mm-hmm. So we seem to have almost a feeling that this could never happen. We can invade other countries, but it could never happen to us.
But you also have this silly masculine, you know, attachment to our dominance. You elected by acting like you're invincible and that you're Superman.
Sure.
You know, John Kerry and John McCain,
sure.
And they're picking fights with these superpowers, acting like we're invincible when you're not. And they're not on the front lines. You're never going to see relative
Marshawn, bears. We have to bring this to an end, this discussion to an end shortly. But could you just briefly talk about how you would change U.S. military policy in light of the threats from Russia that we've talked about?
Absolutely. I would pull our forces back. I'd immediately begin consolidating our military strength, investing in conventional warfare hardware, restoring our sonar nets, investing in new submarine technology, and certainly investing much more in our National Guard and our reserve. Because let's face it, if we get hit, it's going to be the Guard and Reserve that are going to have to take the brunt of it, and our infrastructure. Because right now, with the condition our infrastructure is in, there is no way that we can respond to one hurricane that hits the East Coast and destroys New Jersey, let alone a missile attack which flattens our major cities. What people have to realize, and this is, you know, the last message that I want to send to our viewers and our listeners, is we can't afford to pick a fight with these guys anymore. Let's drop this pseudo masculine, you know, we're number one, and let's face reality and focus on the fact that if we don't protect ourselves, if we don't invest in our infrastructure, if we don't forget the TSA and Homeland Security, let's invest in our National Guard, because if we don't, we could end up getting really hurt and a lot of people could end up dying needlessly.
Well, thanks very much, Marshawn. That's it for the show. On behalf of In Context Military Affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe, producer Gus Candavero, this is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
See ya.
Cheers.
You've been listening to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at wpkn.org. You can also watch this show at youtube.com/incontextreport. This program will be archived at WPKN.org, on our show's website, incontextreport.com, and on our YouTube channel. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org.